people that are facing things that we can't even imagine. And I thought about this yesterday. I was on a golf course, and it was a scramble, and it was kind of slow, and so we're like waiting between holes, and I was on Twitter kind of like scrolling through, and there was this video that I watched that was just absolutely heart-rending, where the people over in Kabul are pushed up against the gate trying to get into the airport there, and they were passing their children over top of the people. So these people who have families and little children, they're like passing them over top, trying to get them to the front of the gate. And I don't know what the plan is there. I mean, if the child gets on or whatever, but it just shows the absolute heart-rending condition that's happening there. And I was thinking, you know, here I'm sitting on this golf course, and just the stark contrast between what does that look like. You know, there's nothing wrong with golfing, but it felt like this weird contrast of what are they dealing with over there where their life is hanging in the balance, and my life isn't really. I mean, I have such a good life, and it kind of segues a little bit into the message a bit today of Ecclesiastes, just kind of what we get wrapped up in. Before we get into that, I do have a couple things. Have a praise report. There was a church hotline that was run about Zane and Jeannie's son, Max, and he was up in the hospital, and I don't know all the details of everything that went on, but I know he was in the hospital for a number of days. I know he was supposed to be in the hospital for quite a while, and he got released early. The doctors are really encouraged with the progress that he's made, and he's doing a lot better. He's still fairly weak and everything, but I just want to have a brief prayer for Max this morning. So if we could bow our heads, we'll pray for him. Dear God, we thank you so much that you are a God that is in control of everything. You're a God that takes care of us. You're the creator. You're the healer. And dear God, we want to pray a special prayer for Max this morning. You know his condition. You know how he's feeling, dear God, because you made him and you know him better than we do. And dear God, if you would just put your hand of healing on Max, just heal him, dear God. We know if it's your will that you can do that. We believe in that completely. And we want to thank you so much for the gift of your son and what he can do in our lives as well. And just pray for Zane and Jeannie as they take care of him and the struggles that they face as well, that you would just be with them and you would comfort them and give them strength. We ask this all in your name, amen. Two more announcement type things. There are sign-up sheets in the back still for the Right Now Media, which is this media that's going to be available to the church. It's a lot of Bible studies. It's a lot of different aids to kind of help in there. So the question had come up before, does everybody in the family need to have an address? I don't think everyone in the family does, maybe some primary people in your family. If you want access to it, it makes it a lot easier as far as logging in. So if you'd have your name and email address, and that's going to be launching next week. So if you've signed up for that, or if you haven't yet, you can sign up in the back. And the other thing is, my friend Jeff Poland is doing a music ministry on October 16th at 5 p.m. at Fairlawn Church. And basically what this is it's his way to kind of explain what his ministry is and what he does. And it's a good time to come together. He's releasing, I think, a new album, a new CD, so you can come listen to that as well. It's a good time. We've always enjoyed it. My ministry, Better Life Coffee, supports Jeff with his. And so Jeff does a lot of good things around the country with youth and really takes a vested interest in young people and helping them be better people. So, yeah, so just if you have some time on October 16th, you can check that out. So my title of my message today, we're back in Ecclesiastes, and I didn't really get through all of Ecclesiastes chapter 1, so I think what we're going to do is we're going to jump in at verse 12. I read it last time, so I don't know if we're going to read it. I might just kind of go through and pick out some things, and we're going to go through Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verses 12 to 18, and then we're going to go through the first, I think, 11 verses of Ecclesiastes 2. So just to recap a little bit, you know, Ecclesiastes is this very depressing book, just to put it lightly. It's not really joyful. It's not really exciting. You get done reading it, and frankly, you just want to, you know, go cry and say, you know, this, there's nothing left. You know, it's depressed. And we talked about that life is really short. There's not a lot to life. It's a vapor. It's brief. The Hebrew word there was hevel, and it's this just very, very short time that we're here. And we talked a little bit about, and I wanted to bring this up a little bit, that nature works in cycles. You have these cycles of the, you know, we talked about that last time, you know, the sun coming up, the sun going down, there's the seasons that happen. And I was thinking about this with seasons. When we get like new, like snow, for example, it's also, it kind of becomes new again for us. Like, we kind of forget how bad the snow was, because you go through a hot summer in the middle of July, you're not really thinking how cold that snow was. So the first snowflakes are kind of, you know, they're a little refreshing. And just like that, you know, once you have a long winter in Ohio, the first signs of spring coming along, it becomes new again. And so I love how God does that. He takes things that, even though they're cyclical and even though they seem repetitive, he actually makes them new. And we see that Solomon was looking, most times he was focused on things under the sun. He was focused on the temporal, he was focused on things that were underneath the sun. He didn't look above the sun. And that's why he kind of wrote it. And we see that if we look past the sun, if we look outside of ourselves, that there is a lot of things new happening in the world. You know, God put a new heart within us. Now we have a new song. He's building a new heaven and a new earth. There's a lot of new things happening. But when we live life apart from God, things aren't new. Things are depressing. Things are old. And it is, you can have a very nihilistic approach. It kind of reminds me, there was this movie I watched one time, and there was this scene in the movie where three guys come out of a bowling alley, and they're going up to their car, and their car's on fire. It's just burning. And they're like, you know, what's happening? And there's these guys all dressed in black around their car, and the guy in the middle, he's like, you know, or the guy on the side, he's like, why are they burning our car? And the one guy named Walter, he answers and says, well, they're nihilists, Donnie. That's what they do. They just burn stuff. They're just, nothing works out for them, and so they're just burning things. And Donnie goes to Walter, he says, but, you know, are they dangerous? Are they going to hurt us? And he said, no, nihilists are actually cowards. And that is kind of true. Nihilists are kind of cowards, because what they do is they just avoid anything that is going to create something outside of eternity. They just want to live for the here and now, and everything is just meaningless. And that's kind of the picture that Solomon portrays here. So if we move into the latter part of chapter 1, the author actually takes on kind of a first-person narrative. He starts to talk here, and I'm going to divide it up into four parts. I think I'm probably only going to get through maybe two parts. The two I'm going to get through is the vanity of wisdom and the vanity of hedonism. So let's start in verse 12. And it starts out, it says, I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem. And once again, Solomon is doing two things here. He's giving us an insight in his search for meaning. So he's looking at it and he said, you know what, I'm trying to find insight. It said he applied his heart. And if you remember, Solomon was actually the wisest man that ever lived. God had given him a request and he said, you know what, I'm going to give you everything. Anything you ask for, just name it, I'm going to give it to you. And Solomon, probably unlike most of us, asked for wisdom. Now, in hindsight, when we read the Bible, of course, we're going to say, you know, we're going to ask for wisdom now. But Solomon was already, I think, a fairly wise man. Because when God asked him this question, you know, what do you want more than anything else, he asked for wisdom. And God gave him wisdom that surpassed basically every king before him and about every king after him. And so when Solomon did that, God was pleased with his request, and so he gave it to him. But then Solomon was trying to find meaning using his heart and searching for existence under heaven. He looked in his heart and started searching for things under the sun. And if we can say this, Solomon had this intention when it came to seeking after pleasure. He was very intentional with it. But he was not looking for things outside of his realm of knowledge. He was looking for it here. So he was sincere. He devoted his heart. He was comprehensive. It said he searched and he was seeking after. And it was also a commendable search. You know, instead of searching for fleeting things, he pursued the life and mind of wisdom. He was trying to find knowledge that you would find probably in textbooks, that you would find in universities, that you would find by reading. He was really looking hard for that. There's a book called Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. It's written by Douglas Adams. It's kind of this sci-fi book, and it's kind of a fun book to read. And I recommend the book. It's really good. But there's this supercomputer. It's really this massive computer. It's about the size, I think, of a city, called Deep Thought. And the programmer came to Deep Thought, this computer, and said, you know, what is the meaning of life? And this computer started, like, just churning through these numbers and algorithms, and it did all this really complicated, and it did it like complicated math problems, and it was doing it for over 7.5 million years. So think about that. Long time. It's just churning through all this. And finally, at the end of 7.5 million years, this computer checks and double checks all its computations, and it spits out the answer. You know what the answer was? If you've read the book, you probably do. The answer was 42. And these people are all looking around at each other, and they're like, in fact, one guy yells out, 42, are you kidding me? I mean, it took 7.5 million years, and you came up with a number 42. And the computer thought about it and said, yeah. You said, I've thought about it. I've checked it very thoroughly. In fact, I've double-checked it. I've triple-checked it. I said, the meaning of life is 42. But then he kind of added this to it. He said, I think the problem is, to be quite honest with you, the problem is that you actually don't know what the question is. You really don't know what the question is to the meaning of life. What you did is you've given me something, and I came up with 42, and you disagreed with it. But you really didn't ask the correct question. And so deep down, we want to know what the meaning of life is, but to get the right answer, we have to ask the right question in the right way. We have to ask the right question the right way to actually know what the meaning of life is. So that's what we want to do here in the book of Ecclesiastes, and I don't think we're going to get to it in one Sunday. And hopefully it's not going to take 7.5 million years, but we want to find what is the meaning of life. Why are we here? Why are we doing what we're doing? Verse 15 says, what is crooked can't be straightened, and what is lacking can't be counted. And life is kind of like this balance sheet where you just can't quite get it right. I'm terrible at keeping a checkbook. You can ask my wife. In fact, I'm so bad at it, I quit doing it. It just is not good for me. I just have a hard time. For one, I hate writing stuff down, and so my checkbook looks very bad. So I can totally emphasize with life is like an account that won't balance, because mine doesn't. But we know there's a deficit in there somewhere. We just don't know where it is. And so life's anomalies can't be straightened out, and we can't really straighten out the system. Like, life just seems to be very crazy. In fact, there was a guy named Leonard Wolf. He's a publisher, publicist. He writes about political theory. He's written, I think, over 20 different books. And this is what he had to say. He said, I see clearly that I have achieved practically nothing. The world today and the history of the human anthill during the last 5 to 7 years would be exactly the same as it is if I had played ping pong instead of sitting on countless committees and writing countless books. I have therefore to make a rather big confession that I must have, in a long life, ground through 150,000 to 200,000 hours of perfectly useless work. So he said, you know what, life would have been better off like if I wouldn't have spent all that time doing it. It just doesn't really mean a whole lot. And Steve talked about this, and it got me thinking the other Sunday. He said about all the flooring that he's laid and what's going to happen to it. You know, all that flooring, you know, you spent how many years of your life laying flooring? And eventually all that flooring is going to, doesn't matter. There's somebody else is going to come along and probably tear it up and put new flooring down. And all those roofs that you guys shingle, all those houses that we build, all that furniture that we make, all the houses that you paint, all the cars that you service, all the houses that you clean, all that food that you make, what is going to happen? What's going to matter in the end? Is your life going to count for something more? And you ask yourself the question, there has to be something more. There has to be more meaning to life than that. So the king's first quest was a quest for wisdom and knowledge. And the quest that he went on for wisdom and knowledge could not provide the answer or meaning of life. And I want to make a small note here. Wisdom and knowledge that Solomon was looking at was completely earthly wisdom and knowledge. It was not the wisdom that was talked about in Proverbs, which is godly wisdom, godly knowledge. And that was inspired. So have you ever wished you didn't know something? You know, there is kind of truth in the saying that ignorance is bliss. You know, if I don't know something, I don't have to really worry about it as much because I just don't know. But Solomon found out that the more he understood life, the greater it made him despair. It just drove him crazy. He went on to say two words here. He said, madness and folly, that usually refer in the Old Testament to crazy, foolish disobedience to God. And what he was trying to do is understand the morality and the difference between right and wrong. People want to live good moral lives, but without God, there's actually no meaning. And in the movie Groundhog Day with Bill Murray, where he just gets stuck in this day that just doesn't end. It's like a 24-hour day. And eventually what he starts to do in that movie, the day just kind of repeats itself. He starts to like, I'm going to go out and do good things for people. And even though he did that, he still didn't have any satisfaction in his life. Like he would go out and he was like, well, why aren't these people relating better to me? Because I'm trying to do good things for them. And at the end, it was just, it didn't matter. So now Solomon's second quest, you know, he looked at vanity, he looked at wisdom and said, you know what, it's vanity, it's that vapor that just surpasses. What about pleasure? What about doing just whatever I want to do? How's that going to look? So we're going to read Ecclesiastes chapter 2, we're going to start at verse 1, and we're going to go down to verse 11. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure, enjoy yourself. But behold, this also is vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad, and of pleasure, what use is it? I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. I made great works. I built houses, and I planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks, and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I had also great possessions of herds and flocks, more than anyone who had had before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delights of the sons of man. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me, and whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil. And this was my reward for all my toil. Then I considered all that my hands had done, and the toil I had expended in doing it, and behold, all was vanity, and a striving after wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun." We see here that Solomon was just wrapped up in pleasure. It was hedonism to its finest. And if you want to know what the word hedonism is defined as, it's the pursuit of pleasure or self-indulgence. And the philosophy behind it is that the highest good and proper aim for life is to enjoy ourselves. That's the whole reason why we're here. The whole reason why we're here is so that we can enjoy ourselves and have fun. So Solomon was like, you know what? I'm going to study this. I'm going to try it. I'm going to do everything I can to understand, is this how life is? And most Americans today, if you think about our lives in general, most Americans today actually probably experience more pleasure than any time in history. Basically, up to the last 100 years, most people's days tend to be just like trying to survive. You know, you think about the Wild West. You think about after that, you know, the Dark Ages, and throughout civilization, a lot of regular common people, most of their day was figuring out where we're going to get food, how we're going to stay alive, what kind of shelter it is. Pleasure probably wasn't as much on the spectrum. It was kind of reserved for the kings and the elitists of the world. Guys like Solomon who could basically, you know what, I'm the king, I can do whatever I want. Yet in spite of our prosperity, or maybe because of it, we still suffer from poverty of the soul. In spite of everything that we have. And the taste of pleasure has grown so much that we crave all the world has to offer, and we try to find satisfaction in it. We try to find satisfaction in that. It reminds me of a song from the Rolling Stones. It's called Satisfaction. And the song, ironically, is called Satisfaction, but he sings throughout the entire song is, I can't get any. I can't get no satisfaction. That's the theme of the song that he sings over and over again. And he says, I can try and I try and I try, but I don't get any satisfaction. It's that crazy thing. And he says, you know, if you go on to the song, he's like, I'm driving down the road in my car and a guy comes on the radio and says, I'm supposed to buy this and I'm supposed to buy that because that's what's going to make me feel good. And I don't get any satisfaction out of it. And we keep on searching, we keep on looking for the meaning in life. And Solomon wanted to get more out of life, so he decided to take this route of pleasure, and he literally tried it all. If you read through this passage, I mean, he was trying it all. He tried comedy, he tried wine, large houses, big gardens, pools, slaves, possessions, livestock, gold, silver, music, fame, fortune, whatever his heart desired, he tried it. I mean, there's no stone that he left unturned when it came to looking for it. And what a life he must have had. He chose to make his own happiness, and he chose to glorify himself as much as he can. In fact, if you look through the verses, I counted through here, it uses the word either I, myself, or me about 40 times in those 11 verses. So Solomon was very self-focused here. He is self-indulgent and in the pursuit of self-centered pleasure. So basically, he's like, you know what? Let the good times roll. Let's do it. The thing that I found while reading this is the temptation isn't unique to Solomon. All of us have this temptation to please ourselves. We all like to please ourselves rather than we like to please God. So I asked myself, what pleasures, and I think we should all ask ourselves this question, is what pleasures am I tempted to take for myself instead of seeking the pleasure of God? And if you look at verse 1 here, when Solomon started out with this experiment, the experiment basically failed about right in the first verse. We see that he started out, we don't get out of verse 1. He said, come, I will test you with the pleasure, enjoy yourself. And he goes right into, behold, this also is vanity. Like, he didn't even get to list all the things he wanted to try, and he was already like, you know what? It doesn't matter. It's not working. So I want to go through this list that Solomon wrote here, and I want to try to make it practical. I want to say, like, how do we kind of relate to this? So the first he experimented with was, I think, comedy or laughter. And he said it was mad, which indicates this kind of moral perversity. It's not the joyful laughter that we can get from actually like serving a god or laughing at like good comedy. But it was this, I think he was using it where he was either making fun or putting down someone else. And I love comedy. I think it's witty, smart. I love good wordsmith. I love watching a good comedian that goes. But after the show, you know, sometimes how do you feel? You can kind of laugh for this certain amount of time, but then when it's all said and done, you're like, okay, when's he coming out with new material? Because, you know, that was funny, but what's the next? And if you Google it, I did, because all of a sudden I started thinking about this. There's a lot of comedians that are depressed. And if you want to think about people that should be happier, the people that want to make you laugh, they should be as happy as can be. But, I mean, some of them in my lifetime is, you know, like Robin Williams, John Candy, Richard Jenny, Mitch Hedberg, they're all comedians that have either overdosed on drugs or they've killed themselves. And it's kind of a sad state of affairs when people that are paid and it's their profession to make you laugh, make you happy, are that depressed. They hide them behind this mask of laughter. They don't show you that deep inside they're actually looking for something more. And Solomon says it right here. He said, when I looked at laughter, it was madness. It was crazy. Next, he tried alcohol, which is another popular way that people seek enjoyment. And you can do it two ways. You can enjoy life with it, or you can use it to escape your problems. There's a lot of people that will do that. And we don't know, it doesn't really say here if he abused wine and got drunk. I imagine he probably tried it every which direction. I mean, it's Solomon after all. Or maybe he viewed it as a gift from God to enjoy in moderation as a fine connoisseur of wines. I don't know, really. It doesn't say. But what he did do is he quickly moved from that to say, life is short, enjoy it while you can. Because he said here, till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. He quickly moved to say, you know what? Everything I'm trying is just so futile and so short. Solomon went after it all. He had beautiful homes, magnificent gardens, fruit trees, pools, forests. He was a botanist, florist, horticulturist, you name it. He tried it. And only a really great, successful person could pull this off. And the other thing I found very interesting with Solomon is he did it all for himself. He wasn't doing it for other people. He wasn't doing it for his wife. He wasn't doing it for his country. He was doing this all for himself. And to pull this off, he needed a huge workforce. It talked about he had servants and slaves that waited on him hand and foot. And when you have that many people, it takes actually a lot of food. 1 Kings 4:23 says, This is how much food they made in a day just to keep Solomon's courts running. He said, 10 fat oxen, 20 pasture-fed cows, 100 sheep, numerous deer, gazelles, roebucks, fatted fowl. All this just to keep this engine running of Solomon's pursuit of pleasure. He was trying to get this done. And he had a lot of money. He was the king. He could tax the people to keep this endless supply of gold and silver coming. He had singers and choirs going. And back in the day, music wasn't just like it was today. You know, you actually had to have live performances. Today, we can click an iPod or you can click on your smartphone and you can have, you know, a couple million songs at your fingertips. Music was a rare pleasure in those days, and he could have it any time he wanted. He basically had a band that trailed him around singing. He also had a lot of concubines. Sex is more common, but few people had experiences like Solomon did. He said he had over 1,000 sexual partners in his royal harem. And this is how he summarized his hedonistic experiences, verses 9 and 10. It says, "So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me, and whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. And I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was the reward for my toil." And rather waiting for God to make him get great, as he had promised in 1 Kings, Solomon decided to make himself great. He was a self-made man. If he wanted it, he took it. If he was tempted, he indulged in it. And he denied himself nothing. And if he was living in today's world, he'd probably be on the cover of Time magazine, on Forbes magazine. He'd be on Architectural Digest. He'd have been on the front cover of all these magazines. People would be blogging about him. He'd be hanging out with the celebrities and A-listers at nightclubs and parties all over the place. And it's hard not to envy Solomon just a little bit, because you think, you know what, if I had just a little bit of it, I wouldn't have done everything he did. You know, I'd have enjoyed myself, but done it in a better way. After all, who wouldn't like to be king or queen for a day? And honestly, think about it. If you could get away with it, you probably would try it. But before you say yes, I want you to know the results of this experiment that Solomon tried. What happens to people who pursue any and all pleasure and make it their main passion in life? And many of us know the answers. And we have as many, if not more, opportunities than Solomon. And I was thinking about this, you know, we look at Solomon and said, well, he had all this stuff. He just was like the richest man that ever lived. But look at our own lives. Look at how we are. In fact, I think Solomon might have envied us a little bit. We have, I believe, probably nicer homes. We have air conditioning. We have AC. We have internet. We have microwaves, probably better furniture. We have huge buffets at fancy restaurants. We have expensive vehicles. We can go on vacations that and exotic places because we can just fly to them. And as far as sex goes, we have this endless parade of virtual partners on any device that we probably want, a harem of our imagination. So we actually probably can look a little bit more like Solomon than we want to think. We can enjoy a lot of pleasures, and we do. We have everything we could ever want or desire, and nothing really is unavailable to us. The American dream is pursuing all that. So I want to ask you the question, are you satisfied or do you want more? Are you satisfied with what you have or do you want more? The answer is probably we're never satisfied. We always want more. David Hubbard put it like this. He said, the pleasure advertising agency is more effective than its manufacturing department. It's always more to how much more that we want. It can never keep up. And we have almost more of everything today, and we really lack nothing except one thing. A lot of people lack happiness. In fact, I was doing some studying on this, and the number one, on the list of the chart of leading cause of death in the United States, suicide is number 8. And this is over a lot of different health problems. And it's a lot of the result of a lot of depression and of unhappiness in the world. And we wonder why when we have it all. Self-pleasure never satisfies and always leaves us wanting more. So Solomon says in verse 11, it says, "Then I considered," and considered here is the Hebrew word called panah, and it literally means to face or to look right into the eye. So if I look right into your eyes, I look right at you and face it. Solomon was facing reality, and the reality he was facing was everything that he had squeezed, all the pleasure he had squeezed out of life, there was still nothing to be gained living under the sun. Our souls want more. Tom Brady was interviewed after winning his sixth Super Bowl. And the interview was asking him, you know, like, so what's next? What do you want? What's the next thing that you want? He said, well, I'm in this pursuit. He said, I think there's still something greater for me out there. Most people think I've reached my goals and my dreams, and I have the perfect life. But he said, honestly, I think there's got to be more than this. This can't be all that it's cracked up to be. And so the interviewer asked him, he said, well, what's the answer? Like, what is that something more that you're looking for? And this was his answer. He said, I wish I knew. I wish I knew. Isn't that crazy? Here's a guy that if you look at who Tom Brady is and everything that he's accomplished in life, like the most winning quarterback of all times. I mean, probably has the most money, beautiful wife. He has amazing home. But he's still sitting there. He's like, there's got to be something more out there, and I wish I knew what it was. I wish I could talk with Tom Brady because I have an answer for him. I do have an answer for him. He can know what the answer to life is. He can know what the meaning of life is. And when we realize all the pleasures that we pursue under the sun cannot and will not satisfy our souls, we actually have to look beyond this world. It's kind of like the game Clue. Has anybody played Clue? Play the game Clue? Maybe we have some Clue players out there. Our unsatisfied longings are actually a spiritual clue that God exists. They're a way to say that, you know what, the fact that we're sitting here thinking, you know, there's got to be something more, I have to have something more, is a spiritual clue that says there's something more out there and that I'm not going to find it just in things. I'm not going to find it just in self-interest or pleasure. There has to be something more. Our dissatisfaction should always point us back to God. And I think reading Ecclesiastes, reading a book like Ecclesiastes here, is proof that God exists, because it's proof that no matter what we do, we're actually going to always point back to God. And Solomon goes to extremes to point this out. He did it all. And the world that we're living here is not all there is. If it was, I think I'd be super depressed. But for a lot of people, this is all it is. They don't know better. And we're made for another world. And I want to say this, God sent his son to save and to satisfy us. And I think if we think of it like this, everything that Solomon pursued, everything that he went after, everything that he did, Jesus resisted, and he was tempted with it, but he resisted fame, food, money, power. And that makes Jesus really the ultimate hero. He was the savior, he was the hero that every dissatisfied sinner needs. Every person that says, you know what, I'm not satisfied with life, I can't find satisfaction, Jesus is the person that answers that question. And Johnny Cash, he sings this song called The Wanderer. I love this song. It's kind of, it's really a moody song, and Johnny Cash has a great voice when it comes to singing. But I think in this song, Johnny Cash was looking for Jesus. Because the song goes like this, I'm looking for one good man, a spirit who would not bend or break, who would sit at his Father's right hand. It's really interesting line. He offers total satisfaction through a crucified and risen Savior. I'm kind of running out of time here a little bit. I'm going to do one more analogy here. If you've read the book Prince Caspian from the Chronicles of Narnia, it's a really good allegory. And there was these two girls, Lucy and Susan, that were walking through the forest with this lion, King Aslan. And they're walking through the forest, and the king is waking up the forest, and there's a lot of dancing and laughter going on, and there's feasting and drinking, and it's this really amazing party. And these two sisters, Susan and Lucy, they're hanging out with the king, and they notice that there was this wild boy dancing there, and he's dancing around, and he's wearing just this little kind of a animal skin, and he had these vines in his hair, and he's dancing, and the girl's brother Edmund remarks after watching the boy, and he said, that chap right there, he can do anything. He might just do anything because he looks like he's absolutely crazy. And later the children find out the boy's name is Dionysus, or the god of wine. And this prompts Susan to make a wise observation. She said, I wouldn't feel very safe with Dionysus and all his wild girls if we would have met him without Aslan. So what the story here goes is, like, God wants us to enjoy pleasure. There's things that God wants us, and he created us this way. He wants us to enjoy it, but pleasure is only safe when God is there. Pleasure is only safe when God is there, because that's what really makes pleasure worthwhile. We taste God's pleasure when we receive laughter as a gift from him. We taste God's pleasure when we receive wine as a gift from God, not getting drunk or making a fool of ourselves, but as a gift of true pleasure. We taste God's pleasure when we design homes, when we build structures for people, not just to make a name for ourselves, not just for our own grandeur, but when we do it to help others. We taste God's pleasure when we go through a beautiful garden, when we see beauty in creation, and we worship and God in that. We actually taste God's pleasure when we sit down to a beautiful meal, a delicious meal, and we eat and enjoy it to God's glory. Not overeating, given to gluttony, but using the taste that God has given us to enjoy it. We taste God when we invest the money he's given us into his kingdom, doing the work that's going to have eternal rewards. We taste God's pleasure when we listen to music, and it delights our ears and it draws us into a worship experience with him. We taste God's pleasure when we engage in sexual relations the way God intended, the way the Creator intended, when it's not selfish, we're not doing it for our own pleasure, but it's in the covenant of marriage between a man and a wife. And God isn't a spoil sport. He's not trying to take pleasure away from us. He's not trying to take away good things away from us. Once we learn to find satisfaction in God himself, then all the gifts he gives us actually become that much more pleasurable. We don't have to be rich like Solomon to experience meaningful hedonism. We have to experience the pleasures that God gives us, just as he gave us a gift from a loving God. And he wants to, and we should give thanks daily for the things he has given us. And John Piper put it like this, and I really like this, and I'm going to close with this. God is most glorified in us when we are most satisfied with him. Solomon looked at earthly pleasure, and he noticed that without God, it really didn't mean anything. But I think pleasure is God created it for us, and he wants us to enjoy it, and we actually enjoy it so much more when we do it with him. The meaning of life can only be found in Jesus. Let's stand for prayer. Our Father in heaven, we thank you so much for the example you've given us here in Ecclesiastes and how it points a life of failure and nihilism actually points us towards you. That we realize without you, we don't have anything. And that we can enjoy the things that you've given us, dear God, that we can enjoy music, that we can enjoy good food, that we can enjoy the company of others, that we can enjoy laughter, that we can enjoy doing things with you, dear God, because you are the author of pleasure. And they actually take on greater and deeper meaning when we have you involved in them. And as a Christian, dear God, I just want to thank you so much for how you've created us in this way, how you've made us unique, and not to take the gifts you've given us, not to take the pleasures you've given us out of context, not to take them and do wrong things with them, dear God, but that we can enjoy them within your context. We thank you so much for our church here. Just pray for the people that could not be attending. Just bless them this week. Bless our church as we go from here. And help us as we just remind us again how good we have it here to God. And just pray for the people that are struggling around the world. If we can reach out, whether it be monetarily, whether it be through prayer, dear God, that we would be a light for those who are struggling. We ask this all in your name. Amen. You're dismissed.